I have in mind to go this time a bit more theoretical than last week. But actually, I have a good feeling that some of the locals are missing, and it's a bit of a pity because there's this local thing called duality, this Santa Barbara thing, and I'm actually playing around with it towards the end of my talk. I'm really interested what the people here are thinking about it. So, what I wanted to do is spend the first 15 minutes on basically summarizing work we did in Leiden during sort of the last 5 years. It was a lot of work, and it basically produced no-go theorems. It's a bit tragic, you work hard and you find out things which don't work. Right? I'm basically doing this because it at least I have to explain my mood, why I'm going to do quite strange operations later on. Again, modified by very recent experiments in the Stripe affair, which I think is fueling a large part of excitement among the experimentalists at the moment, which is about stripes themselves are rather strange states of matter, and we don't necessarily understand them, even though they're not, you know, really superconducting or anything of the kind. Which will bring me to the real purpose of this talk, is to explain the possibility of having quantum liquid crystals. This is family of the stuff Steve Kifferson et al. Are talking about, but yet different. And this is basically work in progress, so everybody's invited to shout at me and to say that I do things wrong. I'm not really convinced that I'm doing it right. So it is really about the stuff happening in cuprates at these low dopings, x less than 1a, where the sense of stripe order is quite strong, right? And in this regime, the experiments are telling interesting stories. Let me just start out telling you about this sort of 5-year, 6-year adventure we had in Leiden. So this is basically about a salt that at sort of intermediate length scale, the electrons reorganize into these collective textures, these line-like things called stripes. I like the way Vic Emery puts it. And Vic says that, you know, the basic struggle we have at the moment in ITC is that we have to get used to the idea that there exists intermediate scale physics, by which Vic Emery means, think about nuclear physics. You start out with nucleons, which are particles. These nucleons, at a lower energy, become nuclear physics, right? Now, yet large energy scales, it becomes atomic physics, molecular physics, and all of that, and eventually condensed matter physics. We are very much used in condensed matter that we start out with electrons, we do sort of renormalizations, and we end up with quasi particles which carry the quantum numbers of electrons. The basic result is that at some intermediate scale, we get new stuff, and this new stuff are these lines, and eventually these lines sort of fluctuate away into something which looks more like a electron system again. Now, given this thought, you can think what is sort of the characteristic physics at these intermediate scales, what kind of things can happen. Now, the idea is then easy that what lines can do is they can fluctuate, they can do meandering fluctuations. These are pictures, again, produced by Dux Calipino and Steve White. This is a decimated conversation group, exactly like for the TJ model. And these are stripes which are, you know, here they form a circle, here they wiggle, here they wiggle, here they wiggle a little, and here they're sort of straightish. The central message is that it's easy to bend stripes.
Are these structures very different than what you would get in a Hartree Fock?
In this very early calculation, we find out that also the Hartree Fock stripes are very easy to bend and to wiggle. Right? And that's that sort of an intuition. When these stripes exist, a genuine degree of freedom is that these lines themselves can do meandering motions.
So these pictures were more or less, the Hartree Fock would produce roughly the same.
Yeah.
The fact
it looks very much the same.
And all that, it makes no
difference. Yeah, and there are reasons in Hartree Fock why the line tension, yeah, if you wish, is fairly small of these lines. And I don't want to go into that right now. So this set is going down in 1993, not knowing that stripes bear any relevance to the problem, but it was pretty unclear to us what this meant. In other words, these stripes are line-like objects. You can call them strings, right? Then when you have a system of stripes and you feel that it's quantum fluctuates, it's like a quantum string fluid. What the heck is quantum string fluid? What kind of physics is it doing? within the constraints of what we know are basic conditions, basic physics, incorporates. I guess when you're very smart, you can right at this moment already tell me what will happen. Probably when you know the answer, you will say, oh, I'm not very surprised. It took us about 5 years to figure that out. And the answer is, the only thing which can happen eventually is at zero temperature is stripe long-range order. When you have a stripe fluid in 2 plus 1 dimensions, or a string liquid in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the strings are made out of finite line tension strings. They have an interaction with each other. Then it will always order into a stripe state. You cannot beat it. Now, this, in order to tell you this story, this will take some time, and I'm just going to summarize sort of the main steps which led us to conclude it. This. Lattice is very important. That's just the next sentence. Started out with this work by Eskes, Osman, Gonzalez, and me. And the basic thought was, what can these stripes do, interpreted as strings? What kind of general models can we write down, and what kind of general statements can we make about long wavelength physics of a single string, stripe interpreted as string? Now, the first statement you can make is that the electrons of I2C live on the lattice, right? They're tight binding electrons. So you would like to make a lattice model of the kind. These strings are defined as little balls living on the lattice, and they're connected by links. And the only requirement is that this line of balls have to connect both ends of the lattice. Otherwise, you don't have a string. Now, what can this do? First, when it bends like this, you obviously have to pay some kind of curvature energy or tension energy. So this costs energy, right? I can parameterize it by saying when I make these little kinks, it costs me some energy, potential energy to do it. In addition, you can quantize it by letting these balls move and under constraint that they keep the string configuration intact. It should be possible to all this still is connected trajectory in the lattice. In between what? These are links on the lattice, right? And this is empty space. Right? So the whole thing can move over all of space. Now, it appeared to us that, after some time staring at this, that you can actually make a couple of very general statements about it. Great. This is a general statement you can make. So strings in principle are very interesting objects. However, high energy strings are very interesting objects because you insist that you define them in a continuum, in a true continuum. Now, for particles, there's always a lattice regularization which works. You can always start out with the lattice and then send the lattice constant to zero, and you can recover the continuum. See, the same is true for gauge fields, and this was the content of this Lynch talk. That's not true for strings. At the moment you put them on a lattice, you basically kill all of high energy string theory. That's the thing. And the result is that the strings which are regularized by a lattice are basically pretty boring objects. So we could consider these kind of models and we could map them on general classes of models, right? And the popular way of thinking about it is in space-time. Like a particle becomes a world line, a string becomes a world sheet, like this. This world sheet is quite generally described by surface statistical mechanics, which you can call RSOS. when you're at home in sort of statistical mechanics, you know what this means. It really, the correspondence is that on the surface, you have an underlying crystal lattice. You have a corrugation. And then you say, you know, the fluctuation of the surface is about putting atoms on top of the underlying lattice. Right? And these models describe that in general. Yeah. And R means restricted, which makes it a bit more nonlinear, a bit more interesting. What these models in generally do is lots of interesting ordered phases of one or the other kind. They do only one critical phase, and that is a Gaussian phase, a free phase. Which means for the string that it becomes a free string. In other words, it's nothing else than in Hamiltonian language than a Hamiltonian of harmonic oscillators describing the transversal sine fluctuations of the string. And you can parameterize the motion of the string in terms of these animals. This is the most important conclusion. This means that the string is characterized by a finite line tension. And I think it's fundamental, there's no way around it. You can already anticipate the problem when you start to make a system of these things. These are supposed to have algebraic long-range order. They are basically like Lunarity liquids, right? Harmonic solids in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And algebraic long-range order is pretty close to true long-range order. At the moment you couple different of these manifolds together, it's pretty hard to avoid oval ordering tendency. It's basically, right, it's sort of simple to see how this goes, right? So let me take a time slot configuration and this thing is straight, right? Well, the next one is doing like this, right? And you can think about this as you know, different plaquettes on the surface, right? And you have this height difference, so it's just another RSOS coupling. Yeah. It's just that the quantum mechanics of the string is just identical to the statistical physics of the surface.
Okay.
Right?
So I'm stupid here. But you have this roughing temperature in the classical two-dimensional surface in the three-dimensional surface. So that's the temperature. Right? That's
and it becomes the coupling constant in the string case. And you know, I can tell you lengthy stories about how it exactly goes. You can basically think there's a hopping measurement here. Right, and when this thing gets large as compared to curvature energies, it's like high temperature in a Euclidean space time.
So large, right? Hopping amplitude is
high temperature. High temperature. Right, so when this hopping is severe, and you can guess it, right, it will also quantum melt.
Okay.
That's the way it works. There was a second effect, which was somewhat surprising, and I'm not sure if it's generic. It's only generic in these kind of models, which is, I guess, a nice way of thinking about it is the garden hose effect. It was actually noticed by Wilczek and Nayak. And the idea is as follows. There are basically two kinds of string configurations. One of them starting somewhere in space, sort of bending back and retracing their path. And there are string configurations which connect both ends of the world. When the string starts, say, at the very left end of the universe and always ends up at the very right end. Now, you attempted to think that both of these types of string fluctuation, string configurations should occur at any finite temperature is indeed true. However, at zero temperature, at least in these kind of lattice models, we found, basically by doing numerical calculations, that actually these configurations are excluded. So there's a basically spontaneous symmetry breaking that by quantum fluctuations, you get a spontaneous directedness. These quantum strings can be delocalized on the lattice, but when they start out at one end of the lattice, they always end up at the other end of the lattice.
Can you be a little more explicit about Hamiltonian? Am I supposed to think about a bunch of particles with some kinetic energy and they have some interaction between the points? How does the interaction depend on the distance? What is the kinetic energy?
Is
the Hopkins problem for going on the lattice with some long-range?
Yeah, I mean, the basic trick is you don't have to worry about statistics, right? Because there's a constraint, right? Saying that these particles have to form a connected trajectory. So it could be that that particle could do loops, like making some long excursions like this, right? And this particle going like here. You have to consider these as virtual processes as long as the string is a string.
So there's some restriction on a possible configuration allowed?
Yeah. And the restriction is that they always have to form connected trajectories of one or the other kind. String. In principle, yeah. These kind of models you can construct. And they don't change the result. Yeah. It doesn't matter so much because the fixed point for the critical string is always this Gaussian fixed point. The most nonlinear thing you can dream of is allowing only sort of next nearest neighbor hops. Right? When you allow for further excursions, it gets more and more harmonic in the transverse coordinate.
It depends on what your parameters are for the
It turns out when you take basically this particle moving in a harmonic well, you can directly map onto a Gaussian string.
Yeah, but if the well, for example, was a linear well, then it would not...
This one is this a well like this, which is much worse than a linear one. They sort of this out. The bottom line is that you always end up with this Gaussian fixed point because of the lattice. You might try to beat it. I would be very happy when you can try a more interesting fixed point. But different things have been tried out here.
I think you're late, but I understand that the people who are here are asking the same question I would ask. What is the Hamiltonian you are actually working with? Is it this harmonic limit, or is this...
I don't want to write down. No, it's not. It's literally as I write it down here on the blackboard, right? You have this trajectory of balls, right? You would like to think that there's a difference between having a straight trajectory or a trajectory with these kinks in it, defined as that these balls make angles, right? You can write down systematically a potential energy, right, on the lattice for that. Then it's quantized by letting these balls make hop on the lattice. And I can write down expressions, but you don't learn anything more than I'm now telling you. Yeah, but I'm just saying, I mean, that's not what we did, but other people did that. Now you can also allow it to hop a couple of times.
Also, you can allow this to be a string to interject itself or not, but I guess it's probably the best.
Now, the point is that by this garden hose effect, right, self-intersections are automatically avoided. No, we were very surprised to find it. The reason that you get this spontaneous directedness, you can sort of understand. When you live on the lattice, the dynamics is always in terms of kinks. Deep inside, it's like St. Gordon. Right? It's basically, you should look at this as sort of generalized St. Gordon. When there are these overhangs, right, the kinks cannot fly freely. They perceive this as an effective wall, which they cannot penetrate, so they cause kinetic energy. And this kinetic energy is like a mass scale for these overhang events. In terms of these models, I mean, we could formulate that for particular models where this is a short-range hopping in terms of coupled RSOS models, two of them, and then there was a basically the Senate is an order out of disorder effect. But that's the way I want to tell. I'm not fully convinced that especially this exclusion of overhangs principle is really a principle. That might be something special to the kind of models we looked at. I like to think it's a real problem to be this Gaussian fixed point. It turns out that the mapping onto RSOS is a bit less literal. I mean, the basic issue is that you need one, when you take a model of this kind, it maps onto a worldsheet, which is governed by an RSOS model describing the directions of the string in this direction, and an RSOS model describing the motion of the strings in this direction. So when you want to have overhangs, both of them have to be disordered. And then the story is that by ordering one of them, moving, always stepping forward in one direction, right, the fluctuations in the transversal directions are optimized. And it's an order out of disorder mechanism. Because of entropy gain in this transversal direction, you exclude disorder on the other world sheet, or the other ISRS model. That's how this base works. I don't want to dwell too long on this. It's basically about the emotional state, right? That we really worked hard to find out stripes which were on this single stripe level more interesting than Gaussian strings, right? And we couldn't find any. And this is important because this basically implies that these transversal fluctuations of the stripes have to be irrelevant. It always wants to order. So there was sort of a part two to this, which was really about what can we say about a system of these elastic strings. Any system. What kind of general statements can you make? It turned out, it was actually where we really started, that there was a rather interesting tradition in statistical physics in the late 70s and early 80s dealing with a classical problem of this kind. Namely, you live at a finite temperature in a quantum mechanics, you live in two-dimensional space, and you have these lines, and they have a line tension, and they only interact by a non-intersecting condition. This problem was considered in the context of incommensurate fluids, where the basic thought was you have some incommensurate system, you can think about it into incommensurate system as making domain walls, some kind. Then, when you raise temperature, these domain walls start to meander around, right? Then there can be a roughening transition, right? Melting transition, and you get a fluid which is made out of these domain lines. What kind of general statements can you make? There are relationships, but I like to think that the problems in general are a bit distinct. This is basically Popsky-Talapov. Sort of the interesting physics in here is that you get entropic interactions. It's a complex fluid in essence, and complex fluids have emergent scales. Now, how can you understand? Yeah, they cannot penetrate. Yeah, exactly. So let me just give quickly the argument. The way it goes is as follows: these lines meander, and at some points they collide. Right? When they collide, the line can no longer freely meander, and that causes entropy. Right? Entropy basically translates into a repulsive energy in this direction, and that means that you get an induced interaction, an entropic interaction. Now, the way you can quickly calculate that, it's a bit of an intuitive way, there are better ways, is by basically saying, let's calculate the displacements as function of arc length, so we pick a point and then we walk forward on the string and we see that this displacement fluctuation is increasing. And how does it do so? I'll use some notes in order to not screw up. Because the strings are elastic, it's easily calculated, and you find that it goes like this, right? It's linear in temperature, inversely proportional to the sink tension and proportional to the arc length. When this quantity gets of order of the average separation between these lines squared, we typically get a collision. In other words, this is the collision length. In other words, this collision length goes like 1 over temperature. Now, the entropic interaction goes like this contribution to the free energy, which goes like entropy times temperature. The entropy goes like the collision density, which goes like one of the collision lengths times temperature. In other words, this goes like temperature squared. Doing a naive coarse grating is dangerous. As I told you, there are better ways of doing it. I don't want to explain because it gets me away from what I really want to tell. We can think that the long wavelength free energy starts to look like it's elastic, like the string itself, in the direction parallel to the strings. And then in a transversal direction, you get it induced into action, which goes like this. Terminal free energy, entropy times temperature, so this goes like delta per U squared. Of course, getting this further, you can basically, you can think about it as it's like an elastic medium. This modulus, which is itself proportional to temperature. Now you can think about this one as an XY model, which is J, which goes like temperature itself. Then there is a Kosselink-Stylus criterion, which says we typically have to balance the interaction, the potential energy associated with vortices, with the entropy associated with vortices. The entropy term goes like temperature itself. When the energy goes like, the potential energy goes like temperature, you have a problem with Kosselink-Stylus criterion. Turns out that the answer is here, that you get a Kosselink-Stylus transition at kBT going to zero, and at that point, dislocations proliferate. So at any finer temperature, dislocations of this kind are proliferated, so it's a true fluid, right? Only at zero temperature, at least in the classical case, you wouldn't really know what to say. Now, as a next step, at the moment you have any finite range interaction, more than this hardcore interest, you get a finite temperature Kosselink-Stylus transition. Now, this is an important one. Think about a striped system. Of course, there are always finite range interactions. This means that at a finite temperature, there's a Kosselink-Stylus transition. So when you consider the quantum version of this, at temperature T is zero, you cannot proliferate these dislocations. Why not? Because they have already condensed at a finite temperature, and thermal fluctuations are always more dangerous than quantum fluctuations. And this is basically bringing me to the point why a system of elastic lines, elastic strings in 2 plus 1 dimensions, always has to order at zero temperature. So, at zero temperature, the problem becomes a little different, but still closely associated with this problem. So you have this problem of these lines now becoming these world sheets, like this is sort of hard to draw, to sketch on the blackboard, right? These world sheets show internal algebraic long-range order in the transversal displacements. They still fluctuate, and you can actually show that also as a system of world sheets, you will have, call it, entropic interactions. There are still collisions, and these collisions still cost now kinetic energy instead of entropy. This sets up a repulsive interaction, right? So even when you don't have any finite range interaction, there's still an modulus, an interaction in this direction. If these locations are forbidden to proliferate, all it can become is a true striped solid. There's no way around it. This argument can be made precise, or reasonably precise, and I refer to my latest paper I put on called MAT. There you'll find sort of the full story of how to calculate this induced modulus.
The argument in higher dimensions will be a lot different because you don't have
to glue
sheets.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. This is really specific for 2 plus 1 dimensions. When you go to 3 plus 1, you get a strange problem where these world sheets, you know, they can start to wind around each other. Right?
You don't get that at all in 2 plus 1
you can imagine stuff of that kind. Scriptless automation is a completely different story. I mean, the basic sort of correspondence is, I mean, you can think about this as one-dimensional quantum mechanics of hardcore bosons, that these are the world lines of hardcore bosons, so it's like a thermal problem of fluctuating lines in two dimensions. This is basically sort of a decompactification, right? You add an additional space axis, right? You open up in the additional space direction, and the internal dimensionality of the world line translates into the world sheet, right? Simply take it out with it. So actually, hardcore bosons in 1 plus 1 and these elastic strings in 2 plus 1 are in a close relationship to each other. Okay. So the statement I can make on, I think, very general grounds is, because stripes are eventually defined on the lattice, when I insist that they are infinitely long, they have to do stripe order at zero temperature. In other words, there's something wrong with my assumptions here. And the only thing, which the only possibility to fight this stripe long-range order is by breaking up stripes. I have to destroy them in one or the other way.
I don't really understand this Gardner's
effect.
Why is it they can't bend back or
form closed loop? It's basically dynamic. I mean, the Gardner's effect, I forgot to tell you why it's called the Gardner's effect. I mean, it's basically like take a garden hose, and when it lies into your garden, it sort of winds up, right, usually. Then put up pressure, and you'll always find that it's going to straighten out and starts to do like this. The pressure is basically nothing else than that you have these kinks, right, which want to move along the string, right? And in order to optimize the kinetic energy of these things, the string better be directed.
The related question I have is, most strikes I've seen, you have some finite width, you're sort of considering infinitesimal strikes.
Yeah.
The width might fluctuate as well as the...
Absolutely. I like to think it's interesting to consider the limit, right, of low density. Because in low density, the possibility of quantum melting is optimized. They have most room to maneuver and to fluctuate. When you go to higher densities, you get more and more direct interactions. So in order to make sort of the argument complete, I actually consider the gas limit. Go to very low densities where you can prove at very low densities that even there you always get stripe order. You will definitely have it at higher densities. Oh yeah, that's the most relevant operator in all business. But it will be static. This order only adds spinning, in essence, right? Makes things more order, right? This is really about making a true quantum string liquid out of elastic strings in 2 plus 1. And the statement is you can't do it. Everything you add to it will increase the tendency to order. Yeah, it will destroy the positional correlation, but it will still keep it classical, right? No, I agree. Coulomb interaction will only enhance the ordering tendency. Right? It's about principle. Imagine that the Coulomb interaction in reality will be screened. Many people forget it. Because the... Macroscopically, it's a metal. So when you look at long wavelengths, there is no long-range Coulomb interaction because, you know, structure Coupe rates are metals. For the sake of the argument, it doesn't matter, right? Because there are 20 million reasons that you can think that adjacent stripes interact with each other also when they're not on top of each other. One of them is Coulomb. The specialty of Coulomb is that it is a long-range interaction, right? And the long range of the interaction really matters for the kind of things you expect will happen. I'm just saying that long-range Coulomb will be in metallic stripes like in Coupe rates, screens away, right?
Okay, those
will differ from any.
Will interact with some kind of parallel interaction, but won't consider it long-range because typically those stripes are not arbitrarily far away from each other on the lattice.
Yeah. You know, for the sake of this argument, I really go to this limiting case where the possibility of quantum disorder is optimized. Right? Even in that case, it has to order. So whatever excuse you can come up with, it won't work. That is the sense of what I'm explaining here.
Another dumb question. I don't really understand why one-dimensional structures are preferred from one and two interactions instead of two-dimensional ones. Why can they have a disorder bigger solid instead of
one? Yeah. Come in. That's sort of the perspective I take from now on. Right? Basically saying these transport fluctuations can be there at short length scales, but you can as well think that you're basically dealing with a very orthorhombic crystal, which is pretty stiff in this direction and pretty soft in this direction. Right? That's exactly the point. Okay, this was basically this introduction thing I promised, and now I'm going to change gear. Took a bit too long, I guess. Because, as I announced, it's also about no-gauge theorems. So, if you were dreaming about that these quantum meandering motions are interesting, I've told you now that they can do things on small length scales, but at long length scale they have to be irrelevant. Let me now switch to this experiment part. What we have learned during sort of the last 2 years is that stripes are pretty interesting all by themselves. There's not one stripe, but there are many forms of stripes, whatever stripe means. It is all coming from the 214 system, where one has access to the full doping regime. In the other 123 and 212 systems, you only have access to this higher dope regime, not to the full doping regime. The story as it now stands is that there are at least three varieties of stripes in the cuprate. The first kind of stripes is happening at very low dopings, and these are about stripes lying along diagonal directions in the lattice, and they seem to be sort of insulating. This is nothing to worry about. Then there's a second variety of stripe between 6% and 1/8.
Half-filled,
yeah. I explained it last week, and I'll show you on the next few graphs why I think that they're insulating. Then there's this regime between 0.06 and 1/8, where stripes are along horizontal directions in detail. More importantly, they sort of coexist with superconductivity. Finally, there's a regime between 1/8 and about 20%, where they appear similar at first sight. They're still horizontal. There's one very important difference, and the difference is in the dependence of the inverse distance between the stripe, this epsilon I was talking about last week, this incommensurability as a function of x. It's linear up to 1/8, and then it stays straight. This is easy to understand. The stripes stay at the same distance while you continue with doping. This means when you dope more and more, these stripes move closer and closer together. I guess I explained last week that this is an indication that stripes ought to be insulators. The reason is that this shows that there's a preferred charge density on the stripe itself, which is here. I don't want to talk about that. I think it's not very clear. I don't think it's completely clear, to be honest. Yeah. Just forget about it. Yes, there was an impression that these things were rotating only in this higher doping regime, and it doesn't appear quite to be the case. You can still, I mean, I would like to see more data. I don't want to talk about it because I think it's far from clear if there's any significance to it. Now, I showed these pictures last week about these stripes calculated either by mean field or by Wider-Scalapino, which are particularly stable if there is a density wave instability commensurate with the lattice on the stripe itself. This means that these stripes are insulating. What you typically want to have is here are 1, 2, 3, 4 lattice sites inside a stripe, and these contain two holes. In other words, there's one hole per two dimensional unit cells. Then the idea is simple. When you sew in more holes, you get more and more stripes, and the only thing you start can do is get closer and closer together. And it produces this straight line. This straight line. When you're here, it has to be different because the stripes stay equidistant, and then you add in more holes, and you expect that the stripes have to be metallic. In other words, this should be insulating, this should be metallic. How does it look like in experiments? It looks completely different in experiments. Look at resistivity. Both for x larger than 1/8 and x less than 1/8 stripes are metallic. This sort of provocative, this is a 10% doping. Here is resistivity coming down. Here is the charge ordinal stripe setting in. And the resistivity even continues going down at 10% doping. This should be the insulator. This is at 15%. Resistivity comes down. Here's the charge ordering. And then it shoots up. This should be more metallic than this. It's actually less metallic. So apparently these stripes are not insulating in a simple way as suggested by these kind of pictures. It's actually a bit subtle because the neutral scattering people are saying that they're static stripe order. However, neutral scattering people don't have infinite time resolution. They measure on relatively short timescales, like tens of gigahertz. So you better go to the NMR people, because they are sensitive to timescale of order 10 megahertz, and they are telling a different story. Their story is, and I don't want to go into any detail here, when charge ordering sets in, there's a phenomenon called wipeout, which means that the signal disappears. They know that the signal disappears because there's a characteristic timescale in the system which is of order of the inverse of the NMR Lamour frequency. So something is fluctuating on a scale of 10 megahertz or so. Right? So instead of calling it real static order, you call it better a slowly fluctuating fluid. Yeah. Chris Hamel, Hans Böhm in Leiden, and Imai, they all seem to get the same picture out. Chris Hamel has mapped out actually the distribution of timescales, and he finds that there's a characteristic timescale in there, there's a mean, right? And there's some width in the distribution which is smaller than the mean. There seems to be a characteristic frequency out there. Everything is fluctuating. My way of thinking about this, which might be wrong, is to think that this resistivity and these slow fluctuations hang together. And NMR is telling us that it's a fluid, although a slowly fluctuating one, right? Hence, it's a fluid made out of charged stuff, hence that has to be a metal. The question I have to experimental is to really sort that out. Again, there's not a big difference between lower dope and higher dope, except then that in 2 and 4 itself, there's stripe order for x less than 1/8, there's no stripe order for x larger than 1/8. In these other three things, there's stripe order on both sides. So, where does the 1/8 point show up as a special point in macroscopic properties? So it shows up in its neutral scattering, but it's basically about microscopy. Question is, does it show up anywhere in the macroscopic properties? It doesn't show up in a very evident way. I mean, the resistivity is not showing much. The superconductivity is basically continuous through the 1/8 point. There's a lot of puzzling. There's one point where it shows up, and that is in the Hall conductance. And it was this Uchida paper which appeared in Science 2 weeks ago or so. The story is that when you look at the Hall conductance for x larger than 1/8, nothing special happens when charge order sets in. That gets very different for x less than 1/8, where at the moment the charge order sets in, the Hall conductance, which I think is the red stuff here, crashes down to become, it seems, zero at the lowest temperature. So the Hall conductance is vanishing. Moreover, this green line is basically 1 over the charge order parameter as measured by X-rays, and that lies pretty much on top of these hole conducting supports. So what does this suggest? When this charge order sets in, the stripe order starts to sort of rectify the current. They can no longer flow in two-dimensional patterns. They start to increasingly flow in one-dimensional patterns. The only way to get rid of a Hall conductance completely is by forbidding two-dimensional current flow. In other words, what this experiment suggests is that a system spontaneously reorganizes from a two-dimensional, obviously two-dimensional electron system into a system which is insulating in one direction and metallic in the other directions at sufficiently low temperatures. In other words, I call this a quantum liquid crystal. The insulating direction is like a charge order or mod insulator, and the other direction is a metal. Why it exactly goes in a simple way, I think nobody knows at this moment. Sort of, and nothing is happening. Yeah, it's no sense of nonlinear sliding transport. It's also strange because NMR is telling us that there is this characteristic time scale of 10 megahertz, right? You would like to go to AC responses and see if something happens at these NMR frequency, and that hasn't been done, to my knowledge. That's an interesting thing to look at. So is this idea of a quantum liquid crystal coming from me? No, it is not. Well, basically introduced by Steve Kittleson, Eduard Fredkin, and Vic Emery a year ago or so, 2 years ago. And I like to think that the best point they have is that in principle, these quantum liquid crystals should exist. Why? We know that 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum systems are like 3 dimensional classical systems. 3 dimensional classical systems are liquid crystals. Hence, 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum systems should do 3D liquid crystals in Euclidean space time, and that you can take as a definition of a quantum liquid crystal. Yeah. Let me tell you. Their suggestion was actually very much based on this notion of having these stripes. These stripes being internally metallic. Then the problem is internally metallic means by them that there should be like literally liquids. At the moment you start to couple together little liquids, you run into this instability, this locking instability that you get this two-dimensional density wave. The density wave correlations are always more important than the superconducting correlations. Now, in order to kill this two-dimensional lock-in, they invented an interesting mechanism I don't want to explain in any detail, saying that these transversal stripe fluctuations dephase the density wave to the density wave interaction on different stripes. In other words, you can keep these literature liquids into a liquid state by having these transversal stripe fluctuations. In other words, in this direction, it's like a liquid, namely a literature liquid, which can become superconducting or not. In this direction, it will eventually become a solid. You only need local transversal fluctuations to get this dephasing. Now, the obvious problem is this one is that I was arguing that there is this epsilon going like X law. When they suggested this, that was not very clear yet. The data has been improving and it's become more and more, you know, something you have to take care of. Now, this had me thinking. It had me more thinking, and sort of learning this discipline. And actually coming up with something which is should be rather generic, and I see that time is running fast. I hope that I can explain some of it in 50 minutes. Then I come in what is still under development. The basic solid is as follows. There's this well-established idea that when you do phase dynamics, and when you start out in a superconductor, that there's a competing state of the superconductor which is actually a mod insulator. I shouldn't call it a crystal, it's quite crazy. It's actually a mod insulator which you can reach by duality. The idea is, consider first the order. To the order belong, by topology, unique disorder operators. Then you can write down the theory in terms of the disorder operators. When the disorder operators condense, you are in the other phase, which is this insulating phase. That's the basic idea of duality. Now, what I want to suggest is that actually in the standard Higgs duality, or how you want to call it, something is missed. Something which doesn't really say is completely wrong here, but it is not complete. That you can see when you start out from the insulating side, invoking the breaking of translational symmetry, meaning it's a crystal on this side. Then, in this duality language, there's basically a two-step process. In the first step, the disorder operators of the crystal proliferate, which is much like vortex lines proliferating or vortex pancake proliferating in a two-dimensional quantum phase dynamic systems. However, because the disorder operators in the crystal are more interested than those in a XY system or in a phase system, they carry an internal degree of freedom, which is called the Burgers factor, that can stay ordered initially after that the dislocation proliferated. There's a second transition which involves the disorder of the Burgers factor, and that brings you into a superconductor. Now, I'm claiming that this is a generic sequence. You can skip this by having a first order transition. So, the standard duality notion is really about, say, a superfluid having a phase interaction, the usual cosine, and then feed it, for instance, with charging interactions. This one wants to disorder the phase, right? And Q and phi are quantified. Just a molecule, right? Okay. So this is like kinetic energy belonging to the phase potential energy. And the basic idea is, and I can, I guess, refer to a couple of people in the audience, start out with the phase order, then create this vortex, and you can basically nail it down mathematically when you have a system like this. We write the theory in terms of these vortices. These vortices are world lines, can become world lines in space-time. When these world lines proliferate in space-time, you get, and they condense, that you get the mod insulator. It's just sort of a neat economic way of looking at these problems. I knew about this. And then, well, accidentally, you know, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in Holland we no longer learn elasticity in our standard theory of elasticity in our standard courses. So I had really to rediscover this. There's this whole beautiful discipline which is called physical metallurgy, the theory of elasticity. And it's actually the birthplace of the whole notion of topological excitation. They call dislocations in this context. Now, also the business of dislocations. The difference with the vortices is really that instead of having just a scalar quantity saying that, you know, counting the number of vortices, these things are factorial. They carry a factor which knows about translational symmetry, the breaking of translational symmetry, and I will come back into a moment, to it in a moment. Now, given this internal freedom, you can let these dislocations proliferate in its duality type of way. However, these factors live a life of their own. They are still there when the dislocation has proliferated, and these factors can order. If that's the case, the basic effect is that currents only can run in the direction into which the facts are ordered and not in a perpendicular direction, which I will explain in a moment. Then when they completely disorder, you get a true fluid. For the ones who are familiar to statistical physics, they will recognize the ideas of Nelson Halperin and others regarding the theory of two-dimensional classical melting. I'm just saying that the same general physics is operative in the quantum case. Okay. So why is it so that when these Burger factors, these internal degrees of freedom of dislocation, are ordered, you get all the current flow in the direction of this Burger factor? Actually, very easy to see. It's called glide versus climb motions in physical metallurgy. It's very well known. It's chapters devoted to this in books dealing with physical metallurgy. Do it for a stripe or two. So here are my stripes. The dislocation is basically a stripe ending somewhere in the middle of the sample. I was arguing that I had to do operations of this kind in order to melt it anyhow. This is just a minimal way of melting a stripe state. Now, it ends, because I was arguing that these neutral dislocations cannot proliferate at zero temperature. I had this little theorem saying that that couldn't happen. Okay? So I'm forced to break up stripes. This is breaking up stripes, causing as little damage as possible. I could, of course, let the stripe completely evaporate. I find it unelegant. Moreover, it's not quite what we see happening in nature, at least in this X less than 1 8 regime. There's still a lot of stripes in order.
They break them up and they separate.
Right. Right. Now we have to consider how this dislocation point is like a particle is moving. Sort of easy. Take a neighboring stripe, cut it here, move the stripe backward, and that I can do with a couple of microscopic moves, hence this goes like T of J, right? And I've moved to this location. Now this Burger factor is pointing in this direction. How to move the dislocation perpendicular to the Burger factors in this direction? In order to do that, I need free particles. Assuming that all I have is order, same stripe order, and dislocations, there are no free particles, and this motion is rigorously forbidden. So this climb motion cannot occur. In other words, when I order all these dislocations, Burger factors of dislocation in the same directions like this, these dislocations can move along these lines. Nothing can move in this direction. Right? In this direction, it's still an insulator. In this direction, it's like a one-dimensional metal. And actually, a one-dimensional metal characterized by hard cores. These dislocations cannot pass each other, so it's not a superfluid. It's a true metal and not anything else. It's basically the kinetic energy associated with it. Right? In order to move these objects, you can sort of think about it. They cost the core energy. Right? When you have them, they can propagate like particles, at least when they have proliferated, right? Their masses become finite and they propagate like particles.
Why are the masses of those things infinite?
Yeah. Effectively infinite, yeah. And the argument is basically that these things can be demonstrated to proliferate always in a finite temperature possibly starting position. So at zero temperature, they cannot exist. For this, it's easy to see that you cannot write answers to zero. Simple argument, right? These things are these banded strings. Strings by themselves don't fluctuate greatly. When you bend them, they fluctuate even less locally, right? These things, right, are some objects in between strings and particles, right? That can, you know, it's wacky motion. particles fluctuate a hell of a lot more than strings, and these things do it sort of halfway. So when you increase the coupling constant, put in more and more kinetic energy, at some point they will proliferate.
So what you're saying is that in the situation where the kinetic energy of the strings moving back and forth is infinitely bigger than any other energy scale.
Yep.
So it's like T much, much bigger than J for the underlying model. Right?
Yep.
That's the situation in which the energy of this object, you would say, is infinitely bigger than the energy
of that. Yeah, right. This is sort of dynamically generated mass. When I make a T bigger and bigger and bigger, the mass of this thing goes up, and this thing will eventually proliferate.
But you don't have an actual formula for what the core energy of that kind of thing is.
I think it's pretty hard to write it down in general.
So
the signs are very clear.
Let's see why the number of n of strings is fixed. Can't that number fluctuate also when strings break and then move
on? Yeah. I mean, you know, when they fluctuate, wait a moment, your question is about the... If the number of dislocation is conserved,
yeah,
when they proliferate, right, it's no longer conserved. You make them a pass in principle. I guess you can basically think the same way as you do in this phase dynamics duality, right? It's at the transition, there's a vortex loop blowout, so vortex says form loops, right? And these are, you know, the growth lines of these things. They always start out in a pair, and they rejoin, right? At the transition, there's one vortex line which traverses the whole system. And above the transition, the number is no longer conserved.
With non-corrupting approximation, you make the center of Hertz look more artificial when you draw pictures like this, you know? You're still not allowing any of these lines to cross
each other. It's low fugacity. And now it's just more general, I think. This is, you know, no dislocation anywhere can cross each other. It's also true for dislocation in iron. They have rigorous hard cores. As far more general, you don't have to literally think stripes all every. Probably I go to the, you know, sort of general formulation to make it more precise.
You said that they move ballistically. Is that important or not? On the top of the
I was referring here to the classic theory, starting with Frank, right? In metallurgy see these dislocations move along these light planes, right? I mean, it's a plane, and they move ballistically. You can really shoot them, right? They have mass terms. Well, in a classical crystal like iron, there is climb, which is basically by the fusion of interstitial and substitutionals to the dislocation, and that allows climb, right? So that's sort of relaxational dynamics. Now, in the quantum case, this doesn't exist. I see that's getting later. Okay. Oops. I like to think that when you haven't seen this before, I cannot explain this really in these couple of minutes I want to spend on this field graph. When you have seen it before, just to remind you, it's about this general duality construction. And basically stole this from Tony Z. I mean, I call this the Wen Z style. There's also a Fisher Lee style of doing it, but basically all the same. So it works as follows. Start out with phase dynamics. It's now written in terms of Ginsburg, Lando, Wilson, right? It's a phase field eta and a electromagnetic effect potential a mu and a mu squared term, Maxwell term. By Hilbert-Schwarzanovich, you can write it in this way, introducing auxiliary field psi mu, basically making out of quadratic term a linear term times psi. Now assume that there is smooth configuration, so most of your system is still ordered. And here and there is a singular vortex configuration. Integrate over smooth configurations, that implies the delta mu psi mu is zero, conservation law, that implies that you can write psi mu in this form, where A is a gauge field, that is a rotation of gauge field. Then it's a matter of plugging this in, remembering that there are still these vortex configurations in your system, the psi squared will translate into a new F mu new term in terms of this auxiliary case field A, basically expressing that this relationship holds, this conservation law. And then there is a deviation of that associated with the fact that you can rewrite this term in this form. This here measures the vorticity. In other words, that measures the vortex current. In other words, in these simple operations, what you have achieved is, instead of this phase dynamics Hamiltonian here in green, there's now a new Lagrangian, which has the same physical content as this one, it's just in a different representation, which is about a new field coupling to a new vector potential A, then the electromagnetic potential interacts with the vorticity in this new gauge field. What's the meaning of all of this? Imagine that this goes Higgs, Meissner. This describes an insulator. So it's developed in the sense that the coupling constants change positions, goes from G to 1 over G. So if this is low temperature phase, it's high temperature phase. If this is small coupling constant, it's large coupling constant. So this is a condensation of this order operators, right? This goes Meissner. What does it mean? Then it goes Meissner, there's no vorticity in the A field. In other words, it decouples from the external electromagnetic field. In other words, it's an insulator. These new fields, Higgs fields, you can interpret it as phonon fields. But Higgs magnets, they also acquire mass, so there are no low-lying phonon excitations. It's an insulator, so it has to be like a crystal, but it doesn't have low-lying phonon excitation. Hence, it's a multi-insulator. And these A's basically describe the supercurrents, and these supercurrents are short-range because they also have acquired a mass gap. So the bottom line is of this duality is that you see so beautifully that the superfluid and the solid are close putters. They're opposite sides of the cone. So the solid can be looked at as the post-condensation of the disorder operator, the vortices of the superfluid. Now, what this has to do with the theory of elasticity. Actually, a lot. And in the past couple of weeks, I've been studying all kinds of strange books about metallurgy. And sort of the basic facts are known and realized by people, although not very much has been done with it. So, what is the theory of a crystal? The long wavelength theory is the theory of elasticity. And it looks a lot like a phase dynamic theory, an XY model, whatever. There's one very important difference, and the difference is that instead of vector fields, there are now tensors. Instead of having the gradient of a vector, you have now to consider tensorial properties. The reason is that the displacement fields themselves know about space directions. This is internal symmetry. This itself is in space. It knows about crystal directions, so you get tensors. In other words, the long wavelength action of the crystal can be written in this way. There's a usual time derivative. However, the space derivatives are now tensorial and in front are the well-known elastic constants. I just write it in this way. Now, all this is mean for the disorder operators. These are the disclinations. That's explained in this Frank loop, as it's called, defining the Burgess factor. So let's do this line integral on a line surrounding this location. This strain field is characterized next to its space derivative direction, also by its internal direction. But let's do this loop integral, start out here, walk all the letters from point to point, right? Then when there's a dislocation in the middle, you have to make an additional step, because the dislocation is one additional row of atoms. Right? In other words, when you do this loop integral, you find that the outcome is, when a dislocation is enclosed, an integer number associated with a particular direction in space, and the Burger factor, which is nothing else, an effect you can make out of this, that these are the different letters factors. So the dislocation knows about the fact that you have broken translational symmetry, and it can be expressed in terms of this factor, which is a factor of the crystal lattice. This can also be written in differential form. In other words, the dislocation can be written in terms of these conserved currents. And all the time there's this additional internal label hanging around, and this internal label is always associated with lattice factors. It remembers the global translational symmetry breaking of the crystal. Remarkably, these currents are invariant under gauge transformations involving a strain field. So when you have the strain field, you can do a gauge transformation to it, and the current maps on itself. In other words, when the dislocations are proliferated, the strain fields themselves become genuine gauge fields.
I didn't understand that you're allowed to separate the Latin or Greek images. They transform separately.
Yeah. A is only space indices, yeah. Right?
And no, but they don't transform together. A and alpha transform separately.
Statement is that they transform separately, right? It's basically like you have in three-dimensional space x, y, and z gauge fields, and they are simply three separate independent gauge fields.
Why is that allowed?
There is a precise answer I can give to you, but I want to do that a little later. I'm nearly there, right? But there's indeed an approximation. And the full thing is really very interesting, but let me come to that later. Now you have to wonder about how to couple the electromagnetic field to these dislocation currents. Now, to express this fact of glide motion, you better put in here little tensors connecting this external label with the directions of the vector potential. So it's basically like when you want to measure the charge of the dislocation, it's like the space integral and sees both. It doesn't matter if it's an A or a B type, X or Y type dislocation. For the glide, it does matter if its Burgers factor is pointing in the same direction as electromagnetic field or not. Right? So this expresses simply the fact that
but
you cannot move.
So the single twiddle is the thing that connects the two kinds
of
indices.
And I like to say, in last instance, it's an approximation. Yeah, let me, you know, I'm nearly there, and I understand this takes far too long. I just want to get this finished, right? So the basic assertion is, everything is the same except that we have these Burgers labels hanging around, right? Oh, everything is coming back. Everyone is coming back as cookies, okay. And again, I basically follow the same procedure as before, except that I have to worry about the fact that there are tensors hanging around, which is A and B fields, A and B labels all the time. And I basically end up with an action of the kind, which is very much like in its phase duality, except that I have to hang on these labels associated with the Burger factors. These Burger factors, I mean, the basic bottom line is here that the Burger factors remember the translational symmetry breaking of the crystal. They still know about lattice direction of the crystal. So although the dislocations proliferate, they have still a memory of that, and that is coded into these additional labels. Now, as the workings of this, first, I guess, sort of a general message, when you just forget about these burger labels, what do you get? You basically get the same structure as for this phase duality thing, except then that now the Meissner phase of this thing is a superconductor which still remembers the phonons of the crystal. So also in a superconductor there's still short-range crystalline correlations, and that is now expressed by these labels. So I think that is rather obvious. However, we are not allowed to do these integrations or to throw away these Burger factor labels. And I guess the easiest way to look at it is that you get interactions, so you have these world lines hanging around associated with dislocations, and they carry these Burger factors, and these Burger factors have interactions of this kind. You can basically say, forget where the world lines exactly are, but there are these arrows attached to them, and they decouple, right? And they do sort of a spin problem. And this was basically recognized by all the way.
The elastic dipole.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, square, absolutely. Typo. And this is missing also in what Nelson Halperin were telling us.
And how are you starting
this kind of industry? Use only the Burgers field, right? I basically integrated out everything, and I just look at the effective interaction between these factors. And these are all coded in terms of lattice factors, right? It remembers the global translational symmetry breaking. In other words, you have basically an effective problem like the blowout of vortex loops is marginally different from that of the normal phase dynamics. It all works sort of the same way. The logarithms are all around. Then there is a dual problem left, which is the interaction between these Burger factors, which is much like a spin problem. That will order two, and when that happens, the Burger factors are ordered, and you get this quantum smectic behavior.
Either one or another.
Okay. You mean either one or the other?
Well, if the dislocation
loops haven't proliferated, you don't have a system of Burger factors. The dislocation of particles carrying the Burger factors. So when there's no particles, no Burger factors. When the dislocations have proliferated, you have these particles having these little internal arrows, right, which interact, right? When they order, they cause this peculiar property that the particle can only move in a direction where the factors are pointing. Then, in order to get the full fluid, you have to disorder these factors, and that you can only do by discrimination and binding. This smectic thing, which is like a one-dimensional metal.
Yeah.
Right? Currents can only move in the direction of the Burger factor. I like to think that for the stripes, it even works better. This should be rather general, but there are always problems of the kind that you can make out of several second-order phase transitions or first-order transitions. So helium-4 is not melting in this kind. In this way, it's very clear. In such, there's an additional advantage, namely, assuming this x less than 1/8 phase being not insulating in this direction, is even not a long wavelength displacement field, because that's massive, right? That there's a mod gap. Right? So, this sort of nice situation, in this direction it's a crystal, because it's incommensurate, in this direction it's a mod insulator. So, it's very simple to make dislocations here, in this direction, they don't make sense. We cannot even write down a long wavelength elastic theory for this direction because it's not insulating. Now, I basically want to stop because this took too long.
Are you not going to get on the biscuits.
Yeah. Okay. Just answering the question of Tony, there are a couple of more things I can say about it, but I just want to stop here. Amusingly, it's indeed an approximation I was presenting. And I like to say that approximation controlled by low fugacity. When the density of dislocations is sufficiently low, you can get away with these gauge fields having these additional global translational symmetry labels. That's what they are. Turns out that there is a great tradition, amazingly interesting, that when you go to the general case where the dislocation density can be of order unity, that the only proper way of writing this down is basically in general in the classical limit, in the form of a series, it's very close to general relativity. Right? You can sort of feel it. It's about the tensorial structure, and it becomes quite literally like general relativity. Well, the percentage is a linearized approximation to that. Now, I like to think that in itself the construction works because you can always go to a low fugacity limit and consider the problem. The full problem is far more interesting and makes me wonder what we have really understood from the best metaphysics. Excuse me? Yeah, sort of. I can't help it. But I haven't sufficiently understood this to make any statement. Yeah, there is this connection, right? That the classical limit is like general relativity, and now you have to consider the quantum fluctuating version of it, which might be like quantum gravity. What the heck that might mean. Okay, let me end here. Yeah. I basically did that on the blackboard, right, in a certain approximation.
I know usually it's not the quantized things like that, and you can know time dependence, how things depend on time. And usually it's very hard to know time dependence with implications for some people.
Yeah. The difference is that stripes are made out of electrons, right? When they exist, they're extreme quantum crystals.
Okay.
Right? So it's very different from normal metals, right, which have dislocations, because these are made out of atoms. And these atoms are as close to the classical limit as you can imagine. They don't do quantum fluctuations. Well, they're basically saying is there is an extreme quantum limit of a crystal where these dislocations themselves become quantum mechanical.
Right?
Right?
I have the last
biscuit. Okay, great.
What I'm afraid, though, is that simply what is known is that the dynamics of dislocations, even if the system is classical, not quantum, you can still think about how dislocations move things in elasticity theory. It's not enough to know elasticity theory to know how dislocation responds to external force. You need to know that for quantizers.
Two answers. First answer is that in classical dynamics problems, you have always to put in by hand something governing time dependence. Right? So there's statistical physics, right? And you have to make additional assumptions to get at the dynamics. In quantum problems, space and time go hand in hand. Mu and nu, these labels are space or time. Right? You cannot keep them apart, and it's very fundamental to quantum dynamics. So when you know the statics, you know the dynamics as well in the quantum problem. It's pretty standard. Now, second answer is that, you know, in order to make dislocations move in iron atoms are neutral, so you have to apply stresses. And the form I wrote down for the interaction between the magnetic field and dislocation is basically borrowing from how the interaction between a dislocation and an external stress looks like. So it's modified for the electromagnetic field case. And the reason that I'm doing that is that because the stripes are sort of a charged crystal, a Wigner crystal, right? So the atom carries electric charge, so it can couple to an external electromagnetic field. And I don't worry about external stresses. I'm worrying about what the electromagnetic field is doing because I want to explain, you know, metals and insulators and all of that.
I was worried about the dynamic. Well, I asked my question about when you said that the dislocations were ballistic, and you basically avoided that question by saying that that word ballistic was from the classical dynamics, not the quantum dynamics. But now you just need to be saying the fact that they are.
In the quantum case, of course, it's ballistics, right?
So, well, I wanted to question that. I mean, the thing is that, I mean, if you were to, you could presumably derive the motion of such things microscopically by saying that you have this configuration where the thing is here, and then you have the configuration where it's there, and you want to tunnel from this state to that state. Each of these
Exactly.
is constructed from your other degrees of freedom of your original microscopic model. But the thing is that the stripe is full of transverse fluctuation. And so it seems to me that you would have a sort of orthogonality catastrophe problem, like one, that in fact the amplitude of the tunnel over there would be small.
This is possible because there are purely galaxies.
That's sort